We take broadcasting for granted now. Trust me, that's true on both sides of the microphone. We push a button and can suddenly talk to thousands or even millions of people. Somebody had to make all this work to figure out how to send voices and music over great distances, then have those voices and that music heard clearly on the other end. The story and the early days of broadcasting that followed are the subject of the book The Network, The Battle for the Airwaves and the Birth of the Communications Age. Scott Woolley is the author. He writes about technology and business affairs after studying economics and public policy in college. He was a telecom correspondent for Forbes magazine and, for a time, its West Coast bureau chief. Scott Woolley, welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Thanks so much for having me.
Many parts of the story have been told before. I wonder what the new angle is that you took here.
Well, that's a great question because, yeah, in books, several books had explored the relationship that's kind of at the heart of my story between this famous inventor, Edwin Armstrong, and one of his friends, David Sarnoff, who went on to run the Radio Corporation of America. And what had originally started as a little bit of a sidelight on a different angle, I got really sucked into their relationship, and previous books had basically taken Armstrong's side against Sarnoff and painted him as a real villain, and I expected that's the way that Sarnoff would appear as sort of a minor character in my book as well. But as I went through and tried to find the proof of what Armstrong had accused his friend of, how he had accused his friend of betraying him, I never quite found it. And Armstrong had hired 17 lawyers to sue his friend. There had been investigations in the Senate and the House of Representatives, and yet that proof wasn't there. So I just got really sucked down this rabbit hole of trying to figure out what happened between these two one-time friends.
It's a very extensive rabbit hole. I mean, I'd known the basic outline of the story before, but didn't realize how closely these two had worked together.
Yeah, they were both born 1891 and showed up sort of in New York. Sarnoff is a Russian immigrant and Armstrong is a New York native, and then became friends kind of around 1912, just as the wireless industry was finally becoming real. There hadn't really been, this is before the days of radio, and there was only the wireless telegraph. But these two guys come together, Armstrong having invented the first radio amplifier, the first vacuum tube radio amplifier that really worked and changed radio, made it possible, made worldwide communication possible. And Sarnoff is this sort of up-and-coming executive with the Marconi Wireless Telegraph Company trying to figure out how to make it into a business.
Well, you know, it's a story that anybody who looks up Edwin Armstrong on Google would know right now. Edwin Armstrong ended up committing suicide. What was there significance to the day he chose?
Yeah, and that was one of the things that really that got me so entranced with this story. He and I opened the book with this scene. You know, he's in a penthouse apartment because he's been such a successful inventor. He's an Ivy League professor. He's this famous engineer, and yet he chooses to jump out of his luxury apartment on the last day of January in 1954, which was 40 years to the day after he and Sarnoff had gone down and tested out his first invention on these giant radio telegraph antennas in New Jersey that Sarnoff had access to. So these two guys go down as 22-year-olds and hook up his invention to these giant antennas, and that's when they sort of see they're the first people in the world who realize that these airwaves can be traveling around the globe. And so for him to kill himself 40 years later, I think you really can't take any other way as a sort of personal and final pointed message to his old friend.
Prior to that day in 1914, when they realized how widely the signals could travel, what was the use up to that point of wireless communication, and the predicted use for that matter?
Well, it started out as sort of a neat, you know, only theoretical physicists cared about it the first time, because invisible waves that no one can see and no one can touch, they obviously seemed useless. And then people figured out that you could kind of mimic the telegraph and send, you know, Morse code dots and dashes through the air. But that still seemed sort of useless because the telegraph already existed. And it was really the sinking of the Titanic that made it real, because there were two Marconi operators, and I tell the story of the Titanic sinking from the perspective of the Marconi operators, and they're the people who summoned help so that at least 700 some people could survive that tragedy. And when that happened, all of a sudden the world went from thinking of wireless, if they thought of it at all, as sort of a joke, to thinking of it as this profound and very powerful tool.
So it was a big break for Marconi, and it was Marconi's equipment aboard the Titanic, wasn't it?
Yes, and Sarnoff was working as a manager of the Marconi New York station at the time. He sometimes, I think, exaggerated his role in that tragedy. But the Marconi company had been struggling because they went into business promising to send telegraphs across the Atlantic wirelessly, had failed for a decade, and the sinking of the Titanic really saved the Marconi company in a fundamental way. So it's this great coincidence of how this tragedy turned into this, you know, led to the greatest triumph of the wireless, the only real wireless company that existed at the time.
The Marconi company really sounds a lot like one of today's tech startups, where it, you know, limps along for a few years and requires a lot of infusions of cash and doesn't make any money for its investors, and then all of a sudden, something happens.
Exactly. And I also came to sort of a different conclusion from the primary research on Marconi, and I'm not the first person to allege that he almost certainly faked his famous transatlantic signal in 1901. But this guy was a brilliant businessman and promoter. So yes, he created this company because he was able to sell this vision of wireless. And it was a vision that ultimately proved true. And it's just sort of funny that at the time, you know, he was kind of a con man in many ways, promising things that didn't exist. But he was betting on the come. He was betting that the future would make all these things possible. And that ended up happening not just in that era, but over and over again. If you were an optimist and you bet on the next wireless technology, you know, that's kind of how David Sarnoff made his career, because he always ended up being right.
Was there kind of an, oh, yeah, element to getting to the broadcasting part of it? I mean, it seems like the idea of, like, well, we can reach this ship. You know, we don't need to run a cable all the way out to that ship to be heard. But then so, it seems like it took people a while to figure out, you're talking to all the ships at once, so why not talk to all the people at once?
Yeah, that was a funny thing. And the AT&T, the telephone company, wanted to take over radio, but they didn't see what Sarnoff did, which was, sure, one-to-one conversations have a lot of value, but this conversation we're having now, being able to broadcast it and very cheaply allow thousands or millions of people, was another way of multiplying the value of wireless. So it's funny to think now that that was such an insight, but at the time it really was.
All kinds of fun stuff to talk about with Scott Woolley. His book is called The Network, The Battle for the Airwaves and the Birth of the Communications Age. Back on the Jefferson Exchange with Scott Woolley and you in a minute 10. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is Scott Woolley, who's been writing about technology and business affairs for years. He's put together a book about the early days of broadcasting, pitting David Sarnoff against Edwin Armstrong, but pointing out their friendship as well. The book is called The Network, The Battle for the Airwaves and the Birth of the Communications Age, and nobody comes out as a villain, as David Sarnoff has in many previous versions of this story. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange. Your perceptions of broadcasting and the early days of it, or your questions for the author, are welcome at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. I'm so taken sometimes with the early history of broadcasting, and even before that, and there are some fun passages in here, Scott, about the awe of instant communication when even the telegraph began.
Yeah, it's I think we're very often awed by modern wireless communication here in the 21st century, and the first time you saw an iPhone do, you know, one of the many things it can do, or track your location when you're in the middle of nowhere via GPS waves delivered from distant satellites. But our sense of awe really sort of pales in comparison to what people were experiencing a century ago, when the idea that you could communicate instantly with the other side of the planet through invisible waves, I mean, it seemed magic or crazy were sort of the first two natural reactions I think people had to anybody claiming that you could do such a thing in 1900. It just seemed ludicrous.
It's impossible. It can't be done, that sort of thing, yeah. So let's bring in another name here, because as we're busy broadcasting at 102.3 megahertz and several other frequencies, let's hear the story of Mr. Hertz himself.
Sure. He was a a German scientist who never had any desire to sort of create wireless communications industry. It was not what he was thinking about. He was just trying to prove this physics theory that James Clerk Maxwell had come up, basically predicting the existence of electromagnetic waves in the air. And so, you know, this was the basis that Albert Einstein used to create all his great breakthroughs. But if you're a theoretical physicist in the late 1800s, this was fascinating stuff. Just from the academic side of things. And he said, you know, of course these invisible waves that no one can touch won't have any practical use, but he didn't care. He just was proud of his theoretical breakthrough. And then, you know, everybody else seized on these things and started. Marconi, for instance, when he was growing up in Italy, copied Hertz's experiment and then tried to turn it into a practical tool. So it was a funny, a little bit funny about how this great breakthrough from this brilliant physicist was tied to someone who just never thought that it would actually have any practical use.
I do like some of the descriptions, too, though, the way you give us sound waves and give us things that move at the speed of light and somehow find a way to make it more or less understandable how EM travels.
Well, thank you. And I got to say, I was very confused by all of this when I started covering the wireless industry at Forbes and asked a number of highly ignorant questions to radio engineers who tried not to laugh at me. And one of the great things about learning this through the stories, you know, it's kind of like Michael Lewis can teach you about credit default swaps and you care because the story is interesting enough. And the people are sort of inventing it. And in a very similar way, you know, hearing about these stories and these crazy characters who are fighting over the use and control of the airwaves is a great way of picking up the science kind of as they picked it up. And you start from the beginning when nobody knew what an airwave was. It makes it kind of at least a painless way to absorb some of the science while you're just reading the story.
And of the two major characters, Armstrong was the one who really had the technical knowledge. Sarnoff had sort of a broader level of knowledge. You mentioned he was a Russian immigrant. How old was he when he immigrated, and how did he climb into the world of business?
So he shows up in New York in 1900 off the boat from small village, I think it was actually technically just outside the borders of Russia, but he shows up in Manhattan, you know, speaking Yiddish and Russian a little bit, and by age 16, or 1906, he gets a job first with one of the big undersea telegraph cable companies. He gets fired after a few weeks for taking off Rosh Hashanah, and then has to get a job with the only other communications company he can find, which is the Marconi Wireless Telegraph Company, at the time a struggling business that many people thought was just a stock fraud and in fact really didn't have a money-making business at the time. But it's his great stroke of fortune that he gets in with the first wireless communications company and really helps save it in many ways.
There's just such a gorgeous parallel there where Sarnoff works for a hardwire cable company and then with transatlantic cables and then ends up working for this company with this new unproven technology going on, broadcasting.
Yeah, and it was the beginning of this long battle between sort of waves in the air and wires on the ground or under the sea. And so it was that original fight was between the transatlantic telegraph companies and then the Marconi company trying to take their business, which they eventually succeeded in doing after World War II. They took most of the transatlantic, eventually took most of the transatlantic instant communication business away. But it became this pattern where Sarnoff was fighting with AT&T, the, you know, radio versus telephone, the waves and the wires, up through the satellite age, where all of it, you know, by that point it was waves bouncing off satellites versus AT&T, which really didn't like that idea because they had their network of wires on the ground. So it's this century-long fight between the people with the waves in the air trying to top existing networks built of wires, and it continues today.
Scott Woolley's book is called The Network, The Battle for the Airwaves. Let's talk, how did Sarnoff rise so quickly inside Marconi's company? What was he doing?
He was an incredibly hard worker. He was obviously very smart. He didn't have a great technical academic background, but he was very fluent with the technology, and he was a kind of a Steve Jobs character in that he had a deep technical knowledge, but he married it with this vision of how ordinary people would want to use the technology and how you could build a business around that. So he started out as an office boy, worked his way up to a telegraph operator, you know, sending and receiving wireless telegrams, and became a manager and had that ability of managing people. So he was the chief inspector, running all the engineers of the Marconi company in America by the age of 21 or 22. So incredibly precocious and just had this gift for understanding how normal people would want to use upcoming technology.
So let's bring in Armstrong here then. Where did he come from, and what was it that he was trying to prove that that got Sarnoff to take him out to the big Marconi antenna in New Jersey?
So he grew up in New York, kind of upper middle class family, went to Columbia, sort of an introvert, but at like many boys in the beginning, especially, it was fairly sexist at the time. There weren't a lot of girls playing with radio, but if you were a boy at the beginning of the 20th century, tinkering with the wireless telegraph was kind of a common pastime, and he was better than anybody else at it and had a knack for figuring out how these devices worked. He got his electrical engineering degree at Columbia and was sort of the star student there and was tinkering around with this vacuum tube that Thomas Edison had made some improvements in, a few other engineers, but he figured out how to turn the vacuum tube into this amplifier that would take a weak airwave and make it 1,000 times stronger, which everybody thought was impossible. You know, nobody really believed it. And Sarnoff, in very typical fashion, always the optimist, figured it was worth giving a chance.
So this is essentially what makes what we're doing now possible, where you could boost a signal coming in from a long distance away and make it as strong as it was at its origination point.
Absolutely, and it was until around the 50s, the transistor basically, the very first paper on the transistor described it as like essentially a replacement for the vacuum tube, and that's what it is. When you think about what transistors and microchips can do, it was all those abilities in the amplification and control that started out in the vacuum tube, and Armstrong really was fundamental in building those capacities.
About two generations ago, people heard about transistors and how things were going to be solid state. They wouldn't have the gassy stuff of the vacuum tubes, but now transistors are so small they can fit, what, thousands, millions of them on a computer chip?
Yeah, tens of millions, hundreds of millions. It's going. I mean, that's the Moore's law increase is fundamentally about getting doubling the number of transistors on a chip and doubling its capacity. So it was that transition to solid state, and it was funny. I finally figured out why they make such a big deal of solid state. It's because the vacuum tubes were so breakable at the time. The fact that it was hard to break a microchip or that you could bounce it around was pretty impressive. One random thing I learned in the process, and this didn't make it into the book, was the importance of putting vacuum tubes in artillery shells and anti-aircraft shells in World War II. And the only way we were able to stop the kamikazes at the end of the war was because they actually built four vacuum tubes that were solid enough to not break when they were shot out of a gun from a destroyer, and those vacuum tubes would actually sense when an incoming bomber was nearby and blow up, so you didn't have to hit the plane with the shell. You could just get close. And so, but solid state obviously made this a lot easier, but at the time they had some pretty ruggedized vacuum tubes, as that example kind of makes
sense. Wow, I wonder how much they spent for those. Much more to talk about. Scott Woolley's our guest in the exchange. His book is called The Network, The Battle for the Airwaves, and The Birth of the Communications Age. Your input is welcome in this discussion of early broadcasting. 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. So this demonstration, Sarnoff and Edwin Armstrong at the Marconi antenna array in New Jersey. How big an impression was this on Sarnoff?
It was huge because the idea, basically everybody said if you tried to boost a weak incoming wave, you're just going to boost the static, and so you'll have not accomplished anything. So to see in clear terms, they at one point, they're getting radio wireless telegraph messages from Germany, and then a few hours later from Hawaii, and they're sitting in New Jersey. So to these things that had always been limited to going a few hundred miles, and Marconi said he could get a message across the Atlantic, but had never proven that he could make it work anywhere close to reliably enough to start a business by that point, and all of a sudden they're going twice as far and getting clear signals. You know, it was just this recognition that the power of the airwaves was vast and almost entirely untapped. And that was the philosophy that really drove Sarnoff, you know, for the next 50 years. And I think it continues to be true today.
Interesting, though. What was the reaction from Marconi himself?
Very dismissive. This sort of points out, I think, some of the Sarnoff's genius over Marconi. Marconi was very willing to believe that he had invented the next great wireless device, or that some patent he controlled would, but the idea that somebody else could do this, you know, he was very dismissive. It ended up hurting the Marconi company. AT&T bought the patent first, but it also really points to the limitation of Marconi in, you know, he could be delusionally optimistic about what he would be able to do, but he was not nearly as optimistic about what other people could do, and other people, it turned out, were a lot better inventors than he was.
So how did Sarnoff and friends ease Marconi out of business in America, and what did they build?
I don't think easing is the right word.
Was I being too kind?
Because it happened, and it was really the government after World War One. So in World War One, the first thing that happens is the Germans and the British cut each other's telegraph lines, and now all of a sudden there's no competition between getting messages across the ocean by undersea telegraph cable or through the air. The air is the only way to do it. And so that really forced the Navy and the military to realize the value of controlling wireless communications. So when the war wraps up, the Navy has no interest in turning back the control of the Marconi stations to the Marconi company, which was owned by its British parent company. And so they basically forced them out. And they were pretty fair about it. I think they gave them a reasonable price. But Sarnoff was right in the middle of that negotiation. And so the Marconi Wireless Telegraph Company of America is turned into the Radio Corporation of America, RCA. And RCA is designed to be a sort of central repository of all the wireless patents so that it can license them out and people can get around this problem of everybody owning different patents to different pieces of wireless telegraphy and radio. And long story short, you know, Marconi's kicked out, RCA comes in, and David Sarnoff is now sort of the star young manager at RCA.
And RCA was huge in its day. I mean, we're talking about suppliers of radios, ultimately TVs, the equipment on the industry end of things, the RCA Victor record label. It owned NBC when NBC was huge. I mean, this is a company that grew by leaps and bounds.
Yeah, the end of its birth came at the absolutely perfect time, because at that moment, everybody still thought radio is just about the wireless telegraph and it's just about sending messages across oceans. And Sarnoff was smart enough to see that it was really the dawn of broadcasting. So he makes a deal to give RCA control over the manufacture of radio receivers, gives AT&T the right to manufacture the transmitters, knowing that there would be millions of receivers and hundreds of transmitters. So that was one key thing he creates, helps create NBC as a subsidiary. The Radio Corporation of America creates the National Broadcasting Company. The names kind of tell you the importance, give a sense of that importance. So he creates RCA and NBC into, you know, what by the middle of the century is clearly the biggest media operation in the country.
Scott Woolley's book is called The Network, and it's certainly about NBC and RCA, but a lot more as well. So I'm smiling at Sarnoff's music box idea, thinking everybody could have a music box in their home, which reminds me of the way people respond to Pandora today. But it was ultimately a boxing match that really demonstrated the utility of radio. Explain that.
Yes, at the time, people, you know, there's a big chicken or the egg problem with radio, even if you thought it was a good idea. You know, if the public doesn't have radio receivers, who's going to start building radio stations? And if there's no radio stations, who's going to start buying radio receivers? And Sarnoff's way of cracking this chicken or the egg problem was in conjunction with some charities to put on a broadcast of what was known at the time as the fight of the century between Jack Dempsey, the American heavyweight champion, and George Carpentier, the European heavyweight champion. So this was the biggest boxing match going. They built the stadium in New Jersey for 90,000 people. And Sarnoff really pushed to broadcast the fight, and then, because people still didn't have radio receivers, radio amateurs would host their own events. So you would rent out a movie theater or a concert hall or something, and one amateur would set the radio up so that a few hundred people could hear it around most of the East Coast. And when that happened, it was this sort of proof of, wow, this is really valuable. There are events that millions of people are desperate to hear, and you can't use a telegraph or telephone to, you know, call them up all individually and give them the news. This is an incredibly powerful thing. So it was that passion for the boxing match that Sarnoff very cleverly turned into passion for radio.
So we haven't talked about stations yet. How quickly and haphazardly did stations spring up in these early years?
Very quickly, in the beginning of the early 20s, I think there were 600 some by the mid 20s, and that turned into a big mess because the rules over who could broadcast on what frequency were very unclear. But the demand for people, if you're sitting on a farm in the middle of Iowa, and maybe you get the mail every week, or you get a newspaper maybe every day, maybe you have to go to town every month and pick it up, to just get access to not only instant news, but instant entertainment, I mean, people were thrilled. So the consumer demand was unlike anything that had ever been seen before.
All right, and then the overlapping of the stations created a headache for the federal government that Herbert Hoover was called upon to solve. We'll bring him into the story when we come back and talk more with Scott Woolley about his book, The Network. Back on the Jefferson Exchange with Scott, and with phone calls and emails from you if you'd like to join us in a minute 15. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We're talking about the early history of broadcasting with Scott Woolley, who's been a technology and business writer for a long time, was a telecom correspondent for Forbes magazine, and for a while its West Coast bureau chief. He's written a book called The Network: The Battle for the Airwaves and the Birth of the Communications Age. Deals with David Sarnoff and the early days of RCA, which became a major power in the broadcasting industry for decades, and Edwin Armstrong, who came up with some of the greatest innovations in early broadcasting and ended up committing suicide because he was depressed about what had happened, largely at the hands of David Sarnoff. But their relationship was actually a bit closer than you might have thought, as Scott points out in the book. You can join us on the exchange with questions, comments, emails, jx@jeffnet.org, by email, by phone, 800-838-3760. So a bit of a wild west in the early days of broadcasting, where stations are cropping up all over the place and slopping onto each other on the dial. And this is when Herbert Hoover comes into the story, and a role that many people might not be aware of.
Yes, he was Secretary of Commerce in the Harding administration, the ill-fated Harding administration, and part of the big Teapot Dome scandal that brought down Harding, essentially. So Hoover's facing this political climate where people are very upset over the way radio is being run, and there's this real focus on corruption. So he cooks up what he thinks is going to be a great plan in conjunction with some senators, and that is sort of the birth of the Federal Radio Commission, which becomes the FCC, what we now know as the FCC. So he sets all these rules in this, that the airwaves are going to be public. You'll get licenses. We'll give out licenses to run radio stations for a year or two, and then at the end, somebody else will get to take a turn. It was this very idealistic notion that the airwaves not only are public property, but can be easily shared. I mean, there's obviously some huge problems cropped up in that. The first being that it's kind of hard to build a radio station, run it for a year, and then close it down and, go on to something else. It's a big investment. So what ended up happening was, instead of there being a lot of sharing of these public airwaves, once a station got a license, they kept it forever. And they just renewed it over and over and over again. And as a result, the initial license grant was basically a grant of money, you know, of huge economic value.
License to print money, we used to call it in the broadcasting business.
Oh boy, was it! and so it very quickly went from this idealistic sort of notion about how everybody's going to share this public asset to a very commercial notion of how we can make the most money from controlling these things.
You know, from a public radio perspective, you have to admire Hoover. For among other things, he apparently did not think much of commercials.
Yeah, and neither did Sarnoff at the very beginning, which I thought was fascinating because, you know, RCA made all its money building radios. And so there was this notion that commercials would ruin radio, not totally unjustified. But nonetheless, commercials essentially took over the vast majority of the commercial radio, took over the vast majority of the dial, and there was some eventually allocated to public radio. But you went from this initial setup where people were adamantly opposed to having sandwiching the president's speech in between two commercials. Hoover was very offended by that notion, and of course, that's exactly what happened.
Interesting, because it was Eisenhower, when he ran for president in 1952, wasn't crazy about doing television commercials because he didn't want to be hawked along with the toothpaste and the peanut butter. So lots of people who felt that way at different times. So was it just the sales of the radios that got RCA so big so fast?
Yes. Pretty much every American at home either had a radio or desperately wanted a radio. It was the best entertainment, the best and the cheapest entertainment going, because once you bought it, it was all free. So they were able to, you know, just be exactly in the right place. And to Sarnoff's credit, he sort of positioned them there when everybody, it was the thing you wanted most to buy.
So we get to television on page 110. I had learned myself within the last few years that it was really kind of there all along. I mean, it was a lot earlier than people think, and World War II interrupted it. What's the basic issue that inventors had to deal with mechanically at first and later electronically?
So it was, you know, going from the days of the wireless telegraph to AM radio, that was a big step up to transmit the human voice through the air, and now they wanted to go, and Sarnoff was really desperate to go the next step and start transmitting pictures and words through the air, which multiplied the complexity once again. And one of the things I found fascinating was, you know, you have this, everybody has a desire to say, I think, who invented television, who invented radio, and the history is just so much more complicated than that, especially when you, there were over 4,000 patents that RCA owned for AM radio, and now here comes television, and how many inventions are you going to need to actually make television work? And the answer was a heck of a lot. And so there was the primary debate was whether you build television around these giant spinning wheels that you shoot different colors of light through. That was the mechanical version, and it worked just very badly. And then Sarnoff backed this other version that had been proposed in the very early 20th century, and Philo Farnsworth did make a giant advance in creating electronic television, where you would, you know, the old cathode ray tubes, where you had this gun shooting the light in lines across the screen. That was sort of the fundamental debate as to whether you would go all electronic or mechanical, as they called it. And beyond that, you needed to have things like cameras that could detect enough light and absorb enough light so that the picture would be visible. The early, you know, Farnsworth's version of television was never commercial because they didn't have cameras that could capture light, so that the only way it would work is if you absolutely blasted your subject with intense light, so enough of it would bounce off and get into the camera, and everybody on, you know, A, the image was pretty bad, and B, everyone was sweating after not that long. So you needed this constellation of inventions to make television work, and Sarnoff kind of saw RCA as the company that could bring them all together. It caused a lot of controversy and anger and different among different inventors who all thought that they were the most important.
Jeffrey and Ashlyn sent an email in a while ago, which I think you just answered yes. It says, are you familiar with my good friend Toby Farnsworth's great-grandfather Philo and the patent infringement and court battles with Vladimir Zvorykin and RCA? Let me just phrase it a little differently. Is Farnsworth sort of like the TV equivalent of Armstrong?
Yeah, I think that's fair. Both brilliant inventors, both made really important advances, but both needed the inventions of other people. So Farnsworth, that Farnsworth and Zvorykin fight, to me, it's not that one of them was right and one of them was wrong. You needed both of their inventions to make television work. And you needed the inventions of a bunch of other people, too. So this patent system, and one of the things that really struck me was, this is a patent system that was built in the 1800s and is now being used in the 1900s for inventions or for devices like television that include hundreds of potentially thousands of important inventions to work. The patent system was just terrible at apportioning credit. And so part of the reason that a lot of people are just passionate Farnsworth devotees, and I think they have, a decent case that in many ways he got the short end of the stick. But he was very unwilling to admit the critical contributions made by other people's work in at RCA, among them.
That's a good way to put it. I think we do tend to think in terms of the inventor of something, but the fact is that it takes a lot of people who figured out a corner of it, and then the work merging, sort of like a bunch of coders working on computer programs in different rooms, to put that stuff together to make it into one cohesive whole.
Yes, and it was, and that is absolutely true. And what struck me is just the way inventors would make it personal. I mean, I guess it makes sense that if you devote a couple years of your life to some project and it really works out, you're going to have that it's maybe a little more important than other objective scientists would say. And so you get a bunch of these people in the room together, and it's not a recipe for happiness. More likely you get them in a courtroom all together, and then all their lawyers are trying to say that they were the most important. And it wasn't really a recipe. It was one of the things that drove Armstrong, eventually to suicide, was that he had to spend so much of his life in courtrooms trying to prove what piece of FM radio or AM radio he was responsible for, and it just wasn't a good system for doing that.
Did Edwin Armstrong ever actually work directly for RCA, or was he just sort of attached to it nominally now and then?
He sold several of his early radio patents to RCA, which is how he became so rich. In the 20s, for a while, he was the largest stockholder in RCA, and RCA was pretty much the hottest stock in the roaring 20s, which was a good decade for hot stocks. So he was, he was essentially paid in stock and a consultant, and in the lawsuit that eventually he filed against RCA, there's a discussion, and Sarnoff says, he was never formally an employee, but I considered him as much a member of my engineering team as my other top guys. So it was this technically informal relationship, and then it was ultimately their argument about how much RCA should pay for FM radio, which Armstrong invents in 1933, and that I think is a little fairer. There's arguments about whether it's fair to say he invented FM radio or not. He invented the large majority of it, I think, is at a bare minimum, and so he again thinks he deserves higher royalty payments, a bigger percentage of every royalty licensing fee, and Sarnoff won't go that far, and so that's another kind of argument about credit that really ended up at the heart of their rift.
So with the invention of FM, which has the superior signal by far, and as we know, you can get it in stereo today, when did FM radio stations begin appearing?
Armstrong fights in the late 30s to get the FCC to approve them on the air, and there's a couple experimental stations that go on, and then right before the war, people start buying FM radios in sort of 1940, and then the war kind of puts a halt to all of it. FM does incredibly well on the battlefield. The Army and the Marines in the Pacific islands and have walkie-talkies that are much better because of FM, and Patton's tanks had better radios. So, you know, FM comes out of the war, and it had gotten off to a strong start before it, and now it seems like in 1945 it's just going to take over the world, and that was certainly what Armstrong expected. But it didn't end up working out that way.
Well, the way the story is often told is that Sarnoff managed to maneuver to get the FM band moved because he was so politically powerful and because he didn't want the big threat to the all the NBC radio stations, which, of course, were AM stations. Was it that bald-faced was it that blatant move to just sort of cut off Armstrong and preserve RCA's kingdom?
It absolutely wasn't, and that's one of the things that really got me, sort of started turning me around on who David Sarnoff was. That is the typical rap on him that, you know, and that was Armstrong's allegation in his lawsuit. It has been sort of widely accepted. But in fact, RCA did not support the shift in the band. CBS did, and there were other limitations and regulations that the FCC slapped on FM beyond simply moving the band, limiting the amount of power that FM stations could use, forbidding them from sending programs wirelessly from station to station, which would have been a cheap way of creating an FM network. AM couldn't do that. So the FCC, allegedly out of concern for the possibility of FM monopolies being created, you know, the technology is brand new. Radio stations don't really exist, and they're trying to get ahead of the FM monopoly problem. So the blame very clearly lies in Washington, and behind them, you know, Armstrong thought that this, okay, so then it must have been Sarnoff working in the background. He testifies to Congress. If you look at every moment, you will find the hand of RCA management working in the background to destroy FM. And in fact, it was much more the local AM radio stations who had something to lose. And CBS was actively involved in supporting the rules that crippled FM, and RCA wasn't. And that's why when Armstrong convinced Congress to hold these big investigations, they ended up going nowhere. You know, he just never figured out who his real enemies were and was so aggrieved at his one-time friend, he couldn't see the truth.
Wow, it's an amazing story, and I'm really glad you went down this rabbit hole again because it certainly proved worthy. The book is called The Network, The Battle for the Airwaves. Scott Woolley wrote it and joined us today in the exchange. Scott, thanks so much.
Thanks. It's been a real pleasure.
All right, take care.